You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll examine the two-year suspension and $40,000 fine issued to Husamir Pouliaris by the Nevada State Athletic Commission and discuss how John factored into this ruling. Big John and I will also look at the bankruptcy filing of Ronda Rousey's head trainer, Edmund Tarverdian, in which he lists his gross wages as zero and his occupation is not employed, despite Tarverdian's prominent role with the UFC women's bantamweight champion. And we'll discuss reports that the UFC is considering purchasing the naming rights for the new 20,000-seat arena scheduled to open in Las Vegas this April and host UFC 200 this July. And as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, Big John will answer your questions. Submit them via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, and on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Let's Get It On is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/letsgetiton. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, and MP3 player. Will the high-profile fighter suspensions in mixed martial arts continue? Is this past Thursday, Husamir Pouliaris was issued a two-year ban and $40,000 fine by the Nevada State Athletic Commission for his actions versus Jake Shields in World Series of Fighting on August 1st in Las Vegas. During his hearing with the Nevada Commission, Alex Davis, the manager of Pouliaris, called as an expert witness, you got it, Big John McCarthy. So, John, I've always heard that in legal circles, attorneys say, never, ever ask a witness a question in which you don't know the answer. Otherwise, bad things are likely to happen for your client.
Well, you know what? I think the whole thing was Husamir and Alex Davis's their entire, you know, outlook of this was that if Steve Mazzagatti had done something differently, and they were saying that it's the way he stopped the fight. Let's put the blame on him. Is what they were really trying to do. And I think their idea by bringing me up there was for me to say, oh, Steve was wrong, yes, and that's the whole reason that this occurred, but that's not the reason it occurred, let's be honest. You know, I'm not saying, you know, and I had, you know, I was under oath, I have to say, you know, speak the truth. Steve had, you know, made mechanically what we as officials would say, yeah, there's some mistakes in here. The positioning is not where we would want to be. Now, sometimes we can't be exactly where we want to be based upon the cage and things. But in this situation, he could have been in a different position. I've talked to Steve about it. I told him exactly. I went over the entire fight with him. And, you know, it's a matter of the positioning. It would help, and it's going to help as far as if Husamir decides to continue to crank something the way he did, we're going to be doing something against it to deconstruct that hold. And that's the whole thing. But that doesn't take the onus off of Husamir to let go of the frickin' hold when you know there's a tap and you know the referee's screaming for you to stop and he's tapping you on the back. And Husamir, you know, tried to say he didn't realize it was Steve on his back. He thought that, you know, Jake was kneeing him to the back. And I'm like, come on, dude, please don't, you know, speak the truth. To sit there and you come up with something like, oh, I thought he was kneeing me in the back, just not true. The other thing he ended up saying off of it was, well, he wasn't sure who was tapping him on the back. Well, who the fuck else do you think is in the ring with you? You know, kind of stupid.
It's beyond stupid. And John, you own a gym. I just think of my gym. If somebody comes in and like their second or third grappling class, if they're holding something too long and someone taps, they're going to be taken aside and say, hey, look, you know, this isn't cool. And Husamir Pouliaris, not only an extremely accomplished MMA fighter, obviously a UFC veteran, he entered that fight holding the belt in World Series of Fighting, high-level Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. I mean, come on. There's just simply no defense for that. He knew that the Kimura was on deep. He continued to crank. He felt Shields tap. And then if you can recall, of course, as you can, John, but for the listeners, if you recall or go and find it on MMA Core or Daily Motion, Mazzagatti comes in and he's now slapping his hands on Paul Jarrus. Again, who does Paul Jarrus think is trying to get him out? Forgetting all the taps, he knows that that Kimura is in deep and he knows he has the finish.
Yeah, and he's trying to crank it. And, you know, there comes that point. This is where, you know, you look at it and, you know, the act of a tap, that's the, you know, a submission in that form, that's the fighter saying, hey, you got me. You know, you won. I can't do anything. You got me to the point. I know that, you know what, this is not good for me. I'm going to get out of this fight. And it's that point where most fighters are releasing the hold because they're excited. They just got their win. They got their finish. This is not the time to sit there and say, oh, I'm going to let you feel this more here, and start cranking things in a way that's just unacceptable. It's unacceptable in the realm of sparring, of just rolling and training, or absolutely in the realm of a sanctioned fight. That is not something that can be just looked at and said, oh, okay, it's just a mistake. No, it's intentional. It's wrong. And I'm not saying that I think Huzumar, I think he looks at this thing in a different way than everybody else. And, you know, and we're all different. And I'm not saying, you know, anything bad about Huzumar, but his interpretation of what he should do is absolutely different than everybody else's. And it needs to be in some way ingrained in him. Hey, you can't do this. You need to hold on to something until there is that tap or there is that referee telling you to stop. But once that occurs, your entire realm of fighting is over. Let go of it. You just won. You got what you wanted. You got what you came for. Don't tarnish it, because what he's doing is he's tarnished his reputation. He's tarnished the sport. He's tarnished everything that he has worked so hard for based upon just bad decision-making in letting go of something when he's won. It's crazy.
John, let's talk about the mechanics of just you being involved, because I know that you were attending the Nevada State Athletic Commission meeting on other business, and I guess Alex Davis just comes up to you and says, hey, we're going to put you under oath. You're going to be a witness, probably without prepping you, right?
Well, no, he was on Skype. He was in Brazil. Their entire thing was based upon, you know, they're on Skype and they knew that I was there for the Cal Magalhães situation. And he said, he goes, I know that, you know, Big John McCarthy is there. He says, is he still there? You know, so we could ask him questions. And they said, yes, he's still here, man. I was still there because there was someone that wanted to talk to me. So I was sticking around for it. And you know, all of a sudden I like, uh-oh, I don't want to be part of that. It's not something I want to be part of, but it's something that, you know what, once you call me up, I'm going to tell the truth.
No, you're somebody who I know who your integrity can't be bought. We talked about that on the program last week. We had a listener question about if you're ever pressured by promoters to referee a certain way. And you said my integrity can't be bought. And I know that extends through this. It extends through the way you lead your life. I'm just wondering what Alex Davis, the manager of Huzumar Paul Jarrus, thought you were going to say. Steve Mazzagatti, I don't want to belittle him. He is a very accomplished referee. He came in, he didn't try to release the hold. His move was to start banging on Paul Jarrus and yelling, which isn't by the book. But before you even get to Mazzagatti, let's just look at what Paul Jarrus was doing with Shields. Again, I just don't understand what Davis thought you were going to say that was going to exonerate his client. He's not an attorney, he's the manager, but Paul Jarrus is his client. He's his advocate. He's looking out for his best interest. What did they think you were going to say on Paul Jarrus's behalf?
I really think that they thought I was going to say, you know, Steve was wrong. Steve was in the wrong position. Steve should have done this. And if Steve had done the right thing, this wouldn't have happened. I honestly think that's what they thought. And it's like, okay, you know, this is no different than two wrongs don't make a right. And there's two wrongs here. Yes, Steve was out of position. Yes, Steve could have done this differently. But Huzumar is in control of his actions. And that right there is when you sit there and you try to put it all off on somebody else, no, you're trying to buy an excuse. That's not what happened here. You had the ability at any time to let go of that hold. And the one thing that I, you know, when I went and looked at that, you know, I've watched that sequence in that fight over 100 times now. And there comes a point, you know, we talked about it before. Jake, when he ends up getting turned over, because he jumps over because he is in trouble. He knows his arm is in a bad spot, and he's actually giving up position to try to take some of the pressure off of the arm. But right away, he taps. You know, and this is where you look and you say, hey, he's giving up because he knows I'm caught. I can't get out of this. He's got me. And from the point when he taps, now that's not the point that Steve starts to come in to try to stop the fight. There's obviously about a second gap in there. But from the point where he starts tapping, that arm gets cranked about 14 inches back. The pressure that it's putting on his humerus and the spiraling effect that it has on that bone and the spiral fracture that he's going to end up suffering if it continues to go is uncalled for, because Huzumar knows he's tapping. Now, sometimes we'll sit there and we'll say, well, the fighter didn't know of the tap. He wasn't sure. Okay. But as soon as the referee comes in and is saying stop, and you feel those hands, there's nobody else in the ring. You know what? All of a sudden, the crowd didn't jump in the ring. And, you know, it's just the most ridiculous thing that I heard when he thought he didn't know who was, you know, tapping him on the back. Come on. You know, that right there is when you've crossed the line into now you're having to lie to cover your mistake. You're having to lie to try to make your actions acceptable. And your actions were not acceptable.
The fact that Paul Jarrus, John, to me, is 35 years old, the fact he's so accomplished in MMA, so accomplished in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, there's no chance for leniency. Look, if this is a 19-year-old kid in his pro debut and he gets excited, I'm not saying it's right, but you could argue, look, he got overly excited. You know, we see that. You've seen it as a referee. I've seen it as a referee in boxing. Especially young kids, like, say, under the age of 22, come in, they get hyped up, they do some stupid things. Or at the AMI level, maybe you say, all right, there's some leniency here. We don't think that it's right, but we kind of understand it. I don't know that anybody can say they understand what's going on with Paul Jarrus, other than most people see it as an intent to injure Jake Shields.
You know, and that's it, you know. And look, at every, I'll say it this way. Everybody is different. And, you know, everybody looks at the world through a different set of, you know, eyes. But, you know, I look at Huzumar, he's a nice person. He's not a guy that you look at and you go, oh, he's intentionally wanting to hurt people and stuff like that. It doesn't seem like he's that guy. But no different than, you know, there's people out there that they just don't understand things in the normal context that they've been set up, to where everyone understands a concept the way it's intended to be, but this one person looks at it and their view of it is just completely different than everyone else's. And somehow in this type of situation, his view of what he should be doing and how he should be doing it is completely different than the rest of the fighting community.
Every week here on Let's Get It On, we bring you our poll question. You can cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. Last week we asked, do you feel that Glory will still be in business as a global kickboxing promotion in 12 months? It was close, but 56% of you voted no. This week's poll question, do you agree with the 2-year suspension issued to Huzumar Paul Jarrus by the Nevada State Athletic Commission? Vote yes or no on our website. Let your voice be heard. Go online to letsgetitonpodcast.com. John, we've been talking a lot on this program about suspensions. And essentially, they've been in two categories. They've either been in recreational drug use, mainly marijuana, or performance-enhancing drug use. And this is out of category, but still, it's a 2-year suspension given to a 35-year-old fighter. Maybe this is career-ending, maybe it's not. But I know a lot of people, and we talked about Nick Diaz extensively last week here on Let's Get It On. Nevada is looking at a 5-year suspension for his third failed marijuana test, positive marijuana test in the state of Nevada. 5 years for that, 2 years for Paul Jarrus. There's an argument to be made, though. Don't take years off of a fighter's career. He was fined $40,000. Maybe fine him $100,000 or $250,000. I'm not necessarily advocating that. I'm just playing devil's advocate for this.
Yeah, but if you fine him $250,000, we'll say, okay, you're taking years off of his career because he can't pay it. He doesn't have that kind of money. So what's he going to do? Until he pays the fine, he can't fight? you know, he made $80,000. He had a $40,000 show and a $40,000 win bonus for that fight with Jake Shields. They took half of it. They took the win bonus. And the win bonus they're taking because they're saying, you, in winning that fight, didn't act appropriately. We're going to take that win bonus away from you. Now, they didn't take the win away from him. But if you're gonna find someone, it has to be within a realm that they can, you know, financially make. You know, this is a man that has to pay for his family. You know, he's got kids to support. That $40,000 hit is huge. You know, because when these things happen, and, you know, as soon as you get the check and it's in your hand and you put deposit in the bank, you know, the wife is spending it. You know, there's bills to be paid. You know, and a lot of fighters get into situations where in between fights they go into debt. And then they make their money and then they pay off the debt and then they go back into accruing more debt as they get close to their next fight. And this is a situation, you know, that $40,000 hit is huge. The real thing is, you know, you look at the Nick Diaz, look at, we all know that 5 years, you know, that was an aberration. It's an aberration in the fact that it's not for the marijuana. Well, it was for the marijuana, but it was more of, I think, the attitude of the way that Nick and his, attorneys went after the athletic commission in trying to say that they were wrong. It was, well, we're going to show you we're not wrong. And I think after, you know, time and cooler heads prevailed, I think they looked at it and said, you know, I think that's why they're in dealings with him now, saying, all right, you know, let's talk about this. And I think, you know, that 5 years is going to get changed. You know, what it's going to get changed to, I don't know. But, you know, when you have a situation where you give a penalty that is basically out of balance with everything else that you've given based upon what you're giving this for. And, you know, that's the way everyone's looking at it. I don't think, you know, if Nick had done something that was egregious in, you know, the way that Huzmar, you know, went after and is holding on to submissions, I don't think people would have been quite that upset with even the 5 year because of what it was for. If it was a performance-enhancing drug, I don't think people would have been upset with the 5 year. There would have been some people, but there would have been a lot going, no, you deserve it. You look at what you're doing. But now with, you know, it being marijuana, everyone's looking at it going, well, that's not performance-enhancing. What's it doing to benefit him? And, I mean, what's the point of 5 years off of this? And so that's where people are looking at it. Now you bring in Huzmar Poharis, and you're giving him 2 years for something that truly is, that's a problem. You holding on to submissions and you intentionally cranking something after the fight is being tried to be stopped, this is a problem, and it's been multiple times. You know, he did it. He got suspended in New Jersey for holding on to a leg lock with Thomas Drawl. He ended up getting freaking released from the UFC. He didn't get suspended because he was in Brazil, but he ended up getting, you know, dropped from the UFC for holding on to the leg lock with Mike Pierce. He did it in the, you know, Abu Dhabi Combat Championships. He held on to things. And now he does it in World Series of Fighting. And you know, part of the whole thing, when World Series of Fighting signed him, they said, you're going to be on a short leash. We're going to watch you. And he had several fights. And even, you know, the John Fitch fight, Andy Foster of California was upset with him. He thought he held it long. Now, I watched it. Yeah, I watched it, and Ed Kalantis was the referee, and I told Ed, hey, you know, what did you say to him? And in the back, he said something that, you know, I said, you know, when you're working with a guy like this, this is what you want to say. And that's just, you know, my business with him. But I'm not going to hold Huzmar at a, you know, in a bad way about that John Fitch fight. But in the Jake Shields fight, no, come on, man. You can't do that. And so when you look at the 2 years is, it's adequate. You know, it's long, it's hard. He's 35, but you know, when you're a 35-year-old man, you should know better. You've been told, you've been spanked before.
So, John, a moment ago,
how many times do you need to get spanked?
So, a moment ago, I was playing devil's advocate, but what I think is exactly what you're saying. I think this 2-year suspension is absolutely fair because you have to almost look. I guess the way a court of law would look at it's somebody's record. What type of citizen are they? So, what type of fighter is he? Paul Jarrus has a reputation, not outside of the cage, but in the cage, as a thug, somebody who's going to try to injure you. He's going to hold on to things too long. And you mentioned the Mike Pierce fight, October 2013. Our buddy Keith Peterson, a really good referee, literally dove in on that situation. had he been more tentative, there may have been serious long-term injury to Mike Pierce. And quite frankly, that's the reason why Husamir Poliaris was in World Series of Fighting, because Dana White released him from Poliaris from his UFC contract the next day. So I think if you look at just the type of fighter that Poliaris has been, having that reputation, this isn't like someone like, let's say, who's a very nice guy in this sport. Michael Chandler, rightly so, from Bellator, has a really nice guy reputation. So if something like this happened, you think, wow, that's really out of character. What went wrong in this situation? Or somebody like Jake Ellenberger, what went wrong? But don't you agree that the Nevada State Athletic Commission is looking at this saying, well, what type of citizen has this person been in our sport? What type of fighter have they been? I don't want to use the word priors, but what types of other incidents have there been in the past that have been similar to this?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and there comes that point as the athletic commission here, you know, this is where, you know, you got to look and say, what is their responsibility? Well, the responsibility is to regulate the sport of MMA. But when you have a fighter who is absolutely going beyond what is the rules and the regulations and the norm for the sport, and is doing things that can permanently injure another fighter outside of the scope of the fight, what are you supposed to do? You know, this, there comes that point. You know, I'm not the one that, you know, is telling the Nevada State Athletic Commission how long they should give a suspension for, but in this situation, people can be as mad as they want as far as the Nick Diaz and thinking that was out of line. This one's not out of line. This one is spot on. This is perfect. I know it's a long time. You know, 2 years is a long time for you to have to sit out. Go teach, you know, jujitsu. Go teach kids how to do it right. Go teach them about what a tap means. Because I know when you roll and you tap, you expect the person to let go of it. That's what it's there for. That is our ability, so we don't hurt people. And the Nevada State Athletic Commission was exactly right in that 2-year suspension.
John, I think as a side note, and I know a lot of referees listen to our program, they probably noticed this, and maybe a lot of our listeners who have never officiated noticed this, but you do something that is very subtle and yet extremely effective. When a fight is finished on a submission, when you come in to stop the fight, you know what I'm going to say, you immediately go in to release the hold. Not a lot of referees, not even a lot of high-level referees do this. I know our buddy Rob Hines does this exactly. But you being a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, the fact that Rob was a professional MMA fighter, there are others who come in, they release the hold. Kevin McDonald releases the hold. That is so key, rather than just, and I'm not beating up on Steve Mazzagatti, but yelling at someone or poking someone or jumping on someone's body, you actually go in to relieve the pressure. And you have that knowledge from your jiu-jitsu background.
And that's what every referee should be doing as far as understanding, okay, what hold is going on? How should the fighter defend it? And if they're not defending it and this tap occurs, how do I deconstruct it so I reverse the ability for that person to continue to put pressure on that joint? Because especially when we're talking about a joint lock, when we're talking about any type of shoulder lock, arm lock, leg lock, look at, this is not the same as, you know, a choke. It's different. The choke is, you know, it's bad as far as when it's on, it's, there's pressure and it's, sometimes it hurts. But when we get into certain, you know, joint locks or cranks, we get into certain neck cranks. Look at, when that person's tapping, there's a reason. That joint is being hyperextended to the point where it can dislocate. That neck, when it's being cranked, is being cranked to the point bad things can happen. And if we don't know how to deconstruct it and take that pressure and reverse it so we take that pain away from the fighter, then we're not doing our job properly, and we're not doing justice to the fighter that needs our help, because this is what the tap is. And when we sit there and we say we are going to intelligently, you know, if a fighter cannot intelligently defend themselves and they're saying that I can't stop what's occurring, I need to help a fighter that at this point cannot defend themselves.
John, as a final point with Husamir Poliaris, again, 35 years old, assuming this 2-year suspension holds, and I don't see any reason why it would be successfully appealed or reduced, do you think that Poliaris can and will come back at age 37? And if so, can he be relevant still?
The whole question is, can he be relevant? Because yes, he can come back. You know, the 2 years is, you know, it's lengthy. There's no doubt about it. But he's a guy that has not accepted a lot of damage in his career. And so he functionally, he's, you know, stronger than hell. He's physically really, you know, put together as far as he's got incredible, you know, strength. He's got good endurance. His, you know, brain housing group is, as I would say, is, you know, it hasn't been scrambled a lot. He's in a position where he can come back. The real thing is every fighter has those, you know, ups and downs and those peaks. And he was riding a peak. There's no doubt about it. You know, you look at what he was doing in his run in the World Series of Fighting. You know, he was taking on good competition. You know, you know, just as you know, any way you want to look at it, you know, he ends up, you know, winning the title. He ends up going and he, you know, matches up. He gets, you know, John Fitch. Well, John Fitch fought for the UFC title. And then he fights Jake Shields, who fought for the UFC title. And he's beating really top-notch competition. He's riding the top of his wave right now. And the question is, when he comes back, is he going to be able to get back up on that wave?
Every week on this podcast, John and I answer your questions. Ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com, on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. And now you can submit an audio question by using SpeakPipe. You'll see it on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. And of course, please include a pronunciation guide for your name. Or if you use SpeakPipe, you can say your name. That is exactly what Kevin from Michigan did, who submitted this audio question.
Hi, I got a question for both you guys. First for Big John. I didn't realize that you refereed boxing matches as well as MMA. What do you do in a boxing match as far as being the ref? Are you real strict with clinching and guys holding and stuff like that? Because I love boxing. It's my first combat sport that I fell in love with. I just hate when it gets bogged down with guys clinching and holding. And I was just wondering how you referee boxing. I've seen your work in MMA competitions, and you're very good. And my second question is for Sean. Sean, I just wanted to know if you are going to be getting a job commentating, or you have something in the works with that. That's my question. My name's Kevin from Michigan. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right. Well, Kevin, you know what? I do boxing here in California, and it's I am of the opinion that fighters, when they're fighting, inside fighting is the same as outside fighting, and we get a lot of referees that end up breaking fighters that are trying to fight on the inside because one fighter goes to hold, and holding in boxing is illegal. But you can clinch. The clinch is not illegal. You can use the clinch to move yourself into positions to attack your opponent. So when we have someone who is trying to hold one fighter, while that fighter has one arm free, the fighter who's holding cannot punch at his opponent while he's holding that arm or trying to hold on to his opponent. But the fighter who's got both arms free or one arm free, they're absolutely allowed to go after their opponent and to try to punch them and knock them out, hit them to the body, whatever it is. And I am always the referee that's going to allow the fighter, if he's on the inside and his hands are free, you're going to hear me telling him, you know what, let go of him, your hands are free, go. And I tell the fighters in the back, because you hear me saying something, you know, as I'm talking, don't stop unless you hear the word stop. If I'm talking, it's not saying that you need to stop what you're doing. I could be talking to your opponent and telling them to let go of you while your hands are free, and I'm telling you, go ahead and attack him, go after him, because that's part of boxing. We get a lot of fights where we have fighters similar to, you know, you take a Floyd Mayweather. Floyd Mayweather fights a certain way. He fights on the outside. He doesn't like to fight on the inside. But he will do it against certain guys. But when he gets certain guys, you know, he'll get a Madonna or he'll get a Ricky Hatton. You'll see that as soon as that guy breaks that barrier that he likes to keep as a distance and he gets inside of it and he starts to, you know, get into him, Mayweather would hold. And many of the referees that are refereeing him will go stop, break, and they'll put him back to the position that Mayweather wants. They're giving an advantage to Mayweather based upon they don't want to see guys in tight or he's starting to hold. So he's holding, let me break him apart and get it going again. Well, you're because he's the one that's actually committing the foul, you're giving him an advantage. That's crazy. We need to let fighters fight different styles.
There are styles out there that are long range styles, guys that are on the outside that can pick you apart and sharpshoot you as, you know, with a great jab or whatever and be a counter guy like Mayweather is. But there's guys that are bangers and grinders, and there's those guys, you know what, they need to be able to fight their fight the same as you're allowing that guy that fights on the outside. So I like to have guys fight on the inside. That's what I do.
And Kevin, you asked me about upcoming commentary gigs. So I have already signed with Titan. That's been announced. I'll make my Titan debut next month. That'll be on UFC Fight Pass. I have another organization who I'm speaking with. We're very close to having that deal done. And that will be on Fight Pass. And I think in total, it's very flattering, John. I'm talking to 6 different organizations. I have to figure out schedule, exclusivity, things like that. But I'm really, really pleased, and I'm honored, quite frankly, how many organizations have reached out to me. So what I can say publicly is Titan for sure, and hopefully we'll be announcing a few more things soon because I'm ready to get back to it. You know, I've been going to a lot of the AMI fights in Kansas, taking Ellie, my 10-year-old. She runs scorecards, and I kind of have a weird commentary track in my head as I'm watching those fights. So I definitely need to get back to it. Kevin, well done. And again, if you want to submit an audio question now, go on to letsgetitonpodcast.com, our website. Many of you are listening through letsgetitonpodcast.com right now. Scroll down. You will see the speak pipe feature. Next up, Chris Wooten, who asks, John, I know that a fighter in his camp can request that a certain referee not be considered for an upcoming fight, but can the same request be made towards certain judges?
Yes, it can. You know, if you have, again, it has to be a situation where you're showing that that judge in a particular fight has gone against your fighter in a way that is just, you know, not only unacceptable to your, you know, judgment, but also to others, meaning that, you know what, your fighter ends up, you know, being in a fight and we'll say a judge goes 30-27 the other way against your fighter while the other two judges go 30-27 for your fighter. And you can sit there and say, look, I don't know what it is. This person may, you know, they don't like, you know, my camp. They don't like my fighter. But I don't believe this person views the fight when my fighter's out there in a even and honest fashion. I think there's, you know, whether it's intentional or not, there's some kind of, you know, concept where this person is giving more credit to, you know, my fighter's opponents than he does to my fighter. You can go to the commission and say, we would just like to, you know, I just do not want this person to be part of this fight. And as long as the commission, you know, can look at it and say, yes, we look at that and we can sit there and say that, yeah, I see some type of, and I don't want to say prejudice, but prejudice there in that fight. And okay, we're just going to keep that person out of it. That can work the same for a judge as it does for the referee.
This question from Jeff Hughes, who asks, John, in the Bubba Bush versus Gareth McClellan fight at UFC Fight Night in Dublin, in the second round, McClellan grabbed the cage and changed a takedown that may have landed him on the bottom, placing him on top of Bush. He went on to pound Bush for the remainder of that round, and an argument could be made that changed the outcome of the fight. The cage grab was a foul, and at the moment it happened, caused an advantage for the fighter committing the foul. Would you have stood them back up? Good question.
It is a good question, and it's something that, you know, in that situation, you know, in the back when I'm talking to fighters, one of the things I'll talk about is, you know, what they can do with the cage as far as what's holding, what's not, because a lot of people think that sometimes fighters are holding the cage when they're not. What they're doing is legal. But when it comes to the use of the cage, I will tell the fighter, if you use the cage in a fashion that you end up, your opponent goes to take you down, and because you grab it in a fashion that gives you position, you end up on top, your position, on top position on your opponent, I'm promising you, I'm going to stop the fight. I'm going to take you out of that position, and you'll be lucky if a point is not coming off of your scorecard also. If you use it in this fashion, I'm guaranteeing you, I'm not going to let you keep it. And that's exactly what occurred in that fight. And so would I have done it differently? Yeah, I'd have done it differently. I would have stopped the fight, and I would have got them out of the position. The real question is, do we separate the fighters at this point, or do I take the fight and put it back in the position that it was at before the grab occurred? And that's where we get a lot of referees that they'll do the right thing. They'll separate them. They'll bring them out of the position, separate them, and they'll start the fight. But in many situations, it's a matter of you should put them back to that position and restart the fight from that position.
Remember, email us your questions, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Submit them through our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com, using SpeakPipe, as well as on Twitter by using the hashtag AskBJM. Still to come on this week's episode of Let's Get It On, we'll examine the bankruptcy filing by Ronda Rousey's main trainer, Edmund Tarverdian, in which he claims an income of zero and a work status of unemployed. And we'll discuss the reports that the UFC is considering purchasing multi-million dollar naming rights for the new 20,000-seat arena set to open on the Las Vegas Strip next year. With John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock, and you are listening to Let's Get It On.
Hey guys, if you're a fan of Let's Get It On and want to show us some love and support our podcast, before your next Amazon purchase, go to our website at letsgetitonpodcast.com and click the Amazon banner on the right-hand side of the page. It doesn't cost you anything, and there are no extra steps to go through. But doing this supports the podcast and allows us to continue to bring you great content every week. Remember, before you shop on Amazon, go to our website at letsgetitonpodcast.com and click the Amazon banner on the right side of the page. Thanks a lot.
Let's Get It On is presented by Audible.com. Audible is now offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To download your free audiobook today, go online to audibletrial.com/letsgetiton. Again, that is audibletrial.com/letsgetiton for your free audiobook. Be sure and join me for the 2015 Legends of MMA Hall of Fame Fan Expo and Awards Ceremony on Saturday, November 21st at Sportsman's Lodge Event Center in Studio City, California. There'll be training seminars hosted by Jeremy Horn, Don Fry, Dan Severn, and Ken Yasuda, and autograph signings with Pat Miletich, Mark Coleman, Don the Dragon Wilson, UFC founder Art Davey, and many more. And the night will conclude with the Hall of Fame inductions of Kazushi Sakuraba, Matt Hughes, Chuck Liddell, Judo Gene LaBelle, and Elio Gracie. You can purchase your tickets right now online at legendsofmma.com. Again, that's legendsofmma.com. The 2015 Legends of MMA Hall of Fame Fan Expo and Awards Ceremony, Saturday, November 21st at Sportsman's Lodge Event Center in Studio City, California. I'll see you there.
When looking for new and exciting clothing concepts, look no further than Lambs to Lions. Lambs to Lions has great designs that incorporates the past from boxing with the new and exciting evolution of MMA. We all start out as lambs, but with time, training, and hard work, we can all become lions. Be part of the Lambs to Lions movement and check out all of their great designs. You can get your Lambs to Lions gear at the Las Vegas Fight Shop or go to lambstolionsbrand.com.
Now, back to Let's Get It On with your hosts, Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Well, 4 weeks ago here on this program, Big John and I discussed the comments made by Ronda Rousey's mom, Dr. Ann Maria DeMars, in which she called Rousey's head trainer, Edmund Tarverdian, quote, a terrible coach and a bad person. Now comes news that Tarverdian has filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy in Los Angeles, in which he lists his occupation as not employed, his gross wages as zero, and his income from operating a business as zero, all despite the fact that Tarverdian remains active in his work with Rousey and his presumed ownership of Glendale Fighting Club, Rousey's primary gym. So, John, of course, the reason we're discussing this program is because Rousey is set to fight Holly Holm November 15th in Melbourne, Australia. And as we both know, I think everybody listening to this program knows, distractions are never a good thing in training camp.
No, they're a bad thing. And, you know, if you're the Greg Jackson camp, along with Mike Winkle, John, man, you're sitting there going, this is great. Just keep going. Because they want there to be, you know, that distraction. They want this to be, you know, something that is causing some type of thought process on Ronda's part, and hopefully it's not, you know, it shouldn't. But, you know, when these types of things, you know, come out, there's going to be talk about it, and then you end up hearing that talk, and this is not a good incident. What's happening here, this is bad news, and it's bad news for Edmund. And the fact that, you know, he's saying that he's not employed, he's going to end up in a position, you know, he's got a hearing coming up, you know, what is it, 2 days after?
November 16th, he's got to fly from Melbourne back to Los Angeles, crosses the international timeline, that buys him a day. But November 16th, he's got to meet with his creditors. He'll be asked questions under oath. And that, to me, it's got to be some sort of distraction, right?
Well, not only a distraction, he better figure out what he's saying, because, you know, at this point, man, you know, he's saying he makes zero money. Well, and I hate to tell you, just look at, you know, let's be reasonable. Ronda Rousey is making more money than anybody in the UFC. He's making money off of Ronda. You know, Ronda has to, you know, she has to file taxes herself. And do you think that she's saying that she doesn't give money to either Edmund, or we'll say that it goes to the Glendale Fight Club, you know, and he's thinking that he can get away with it that way? That ain't gonna, it ain't gonna fly. And him, you know, signing over the Glendale Fight Club will say to, I don't know who he's, you know, who's the person whose name is in charge of it, whether it's his, you know, relatives, mother, father, brother, sister, whatever. Look at you, that's a nice way to try to, you know, run this thing around and make it like, oh, I don't own anything. They're not going to buy into that. You know, that it's, this is just not good. He needs to come back and either withdraw that bankruptcy or change it and say, well, I made a mistake on my form, so I can't, you know, testify to what it's saying. I need to, you know, file it again so I can testify. But if he goes in there November 16th and says, I make zero income, I don't have anything, man, he is stepping into a pile of crap that he will never wash off of him. He is in trouble. He needs to be smarter about what he's doing, because this is all bad.
So if you're a creditor of Tarverdian and you're going into this hearing November 16th and you have the ability, or through your attorney, you have the ability to ask Tarverdian questions under oath, there's not a lot of real tough research here. Basically, you just need Google. Forbes reported that between June 2014 and June of this year, 2015, Rousey made $6.5 million. Of that amount, $3 million was directly paid as prize money by the UFC. The rest was for her book and personal appearances, endorsements, outside projects. But Forbes has it right there. $3 million paid to Rousey by the UFC. So even if Tarverdian is getting 5%, which would be a very low figure, I believe, for a head trainer, that's still $150,000. It's not $0.
Yeah, that's $150,000, and that's not all the money he's getting. You know, that's the $3 million they're putting is not – that doesn't have anything to do with pay-per-view or any of that. So that 5%, if that was what he's getting, it's just jumped up another at least $150,000. So you're looking at least – $300,000 that he's made being, you know, the head trainer of Ronda. And I'm not saying he doesn't deserve the money. That's great. But to sit there and to try to say, I don't make anything, you know, look at this entire situation has just blown up, you know, and it could be, you know, I don't know who it was that got word that he was filing for bankruptcy, but as soon as they went and looked for the papers and found them, and you look at what's written on them, man, it's just not good. He does not want to be in the situation he's in, and he needs to be careful about what he does from this point forward. Look at the IRS. I can tell you, you know, I've had problems with them because they're a pain in my ass, thinking that, you know, they've actually thought I was the UFC. I'm getting international fight money and stuff like that. I said, are you freaking nuts?
Well, you make like $1 million a fight, don't you, John? Or is it $10 million a fight? I can't remember which.
That's it. It's somewhere in there. You know? And you look and you go, you're clueless. But you have to prove, no, you're wrong. Because, you know, they'll get it in their mind that, you know, you're making this, you know, big money or something because you're part of this. It's like, no. What I'm filing is honest. I have no reason to lie. I don't cheat. I'll pay my taxes, but I don't want to pay more than I'm supposed to. I'll admit that, but I'll pay what I'm supposed to. And man, he is in a position where, you know, what he's doing, you know, it's in the end, it's going to be fraud, and fraud puts your ass in jail. And so it's going to be very hard to be the head trainer of anybody when you're in federal prison.
So this really puts the context to the quotes we were talking about. And we spoke about it extensively last month on a program. Ronda Rousey's mom, Dr. Anne Maria DeMars, we could not figure out what was really spurring her on to publicly, you can say whatever you want privately, but publicly go after Tarverdyan. I'm not saying this is the reason. I'm saying this is most likely the reason, or at least it's part of the reason.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, she might have known something, you know, beforehand of what was going on, and just, you know, decided, I don't like that. I don't believe in, you know, someone that's going to, you know, try to actually perpetrate what is, it's a crime, you know, just flat out. You know, I like Edmund. Edmund's a good guy. I've never had a problem with him at all. I think he does a good job with his fighters. I have zero bad things to say about him until I look at this and it's like, I just want to look at him. What the fuck are you thinking, dude? You know what? If you've accrued this debt, then figure out a way to pay it off. You make money, okay? Stop living a certain lifestyle. Start doing everything the right way and start paying these people off, because those people gave you that money, or you took that money on those credit cards, and it's your responsibility to pay it back.
And the bigger picture, of course, here is not Edmund Tarverdyan, but for the purpose of our program, it's Ronda Rousey. And maybe if you draw a comparison to Mike Tyson, and I'm not saying that this is the beginning of the end for Rousey, or that she'll lose to Holly Holm or struggle, or maybe she's so mentally focused, whatever her mom says publicly and privately, whatever's going on with Tarverdyan publicly and privately, maybe it won't affect her. But if you think about Mike Tyson, when Customato died, and then he was with Jimmy Jacobs, and there was a change in management. He got with Don King, and then Rory Horn is brought in, and you just started to see kind of the seeds of his demise slowly sown, until it's Mike Tyson being knocked out by Buster Douglas in Tokyo to lose his title, and then going to federal prison. You could look back and kind of see the timeline. Now, again, I'm not saying that Rousey's going to lose. I'm certainly saying that she's going to federal prison. Whatever Tarverdyan finds himself in, this has nothing directly to do with Ronda Rousey. She's in no legal trouble. But there are a lot of non-calming influences around Ronda Rousey, the biggest star in our sport right now.
Oh, you know, look at the whole thing is, unfortunately for Ronda, everything that is, you know, out there that it touches her in any fashion is brought up huge because she's popular. Her name catches attention. You know, if you say the name of Edmund Tarverdyan to most people, are like, who? They don't have a clue who that is. But you bring up the name Ronda Rousey, that gets their attention. Say, oh, I know her. And then all of a sudden something catches on. And so anything that, you know, she's associated with or is associated with her is going to end up, as soon as her name is brought into it, you know, it becomes news, and it becomes something that people try to put out there to catch on, so their headline catches something. But, you know, when you sit there and, you know, you look at what's being listed here, you know, and if you go and you look at, you know, I think it was Bloody Elbow put out there, they're the ones that put the whole thing on, and they have you know, a picture of the document, you know, and it's got him listing everything as zero. You go, God damn, dude, really? You're trying to say for the last 2 years you've made zero money. Come on, man. You dress too nice for that, okay? And it's not all free Reebok shit.
Well, and when you're a public figure too, and he might not be a prominent figure, but Tarverdyan is a public figure because when Ronda Rousey is fighting, he's right there. So he's on television. He's in the media. If he weren't a public figure, we wouldn't be speaking about him. If he were just some random guy who owned some random gym, nobody would be talking about this outside of his immediate circle. But it's not hard to connect the dots, again, especially if you're a creditor and putting Tarverdyan under oath. See, Ronda Rousey makes all of this money. She's the biggest star in MMA. She's the UFC's women's bantamweight champion. You're probably not doing this for altruistic reasons. You're probably getting paid at least something.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it comes down to this. It's like, I don't expect, you know, Edmund to be this financial wizard. I'm not saying that Edmund could not have made, you know, bad decisions with money, like a lot of us do. You know, there's a lot of people out, you know, that are good people that make bad financial choices, you know, and Edmund could have made these bad financial, you know, decisions and done things that you look and you go, hey, I understand that he needs to file bankruptcy. Okay. You know, that's not a crime. It's not something that he's going to be proud of. No one's proud of the fact that they had to do a bankruptcy, but you know, sometimes financially you get put in that position based upon you lose a job, You know, you have all these things, everything works out very well while you have a job and you're able to pay everything. And then all of a sudden that job gets pulled out from underneath you and you don't have anything. And look at those bills don't stop. So this can happen. And I find nothing wrong with it. I feel bad for Edmund for it. And, you know, that shouldn't happen to anyone. But this is what a bankruptcy is there for, is to get you at least away from the creditors to a point where you can try to, you know, start again. And if that was what was going on here, I don't, you know, I would think it's really not anybody's business and everyone should leave him alone. The biggest problem is when he's sitting there saying, I don't have a job, I don't have anything, you know, well, come on. We know that he's not training Ronda for free. That's just not happening. He's getting paid. And the fact that he's trying to pull that is now saying you're not being honest. You're being dishonest. And being dishonest when it comes to these proceedings, you're doing this under the freaking penalty of perjury. That perjury will put your butt in jail. You need to rethink what you're doing. It's out in the open. I don't care what you do. It's your choice. But if I was you, if I was advising you, I would say, Edmund, let's stop that bankruptcy right now. Stop all the proceedings. Let's get this thing going in the right direction. And we've got to figure out a new way of doing this. What you're going to do with what's been going on is going to end up putting you in jail. Look, we've already had Monty Cox, big time manager to a lot of fighters. He just, you know, he pled guilty to a tax fraud. Now, this is a guy that paid $300,000 in tax, and they're still saying he's, didn't pay enough. All right. And he's not trying to say, I didn't make money. He filed his taxes, he filed everything. And because he's not going to give up fighters and money that they got, you know, off to the side, which is what the IRS wanted, he's going to end up having his butt probably put in federal prison for a year for tax evasion. He had to say he's, this person that evaded taxes when he paid taxes. This is a completely different situation. And he's already in the position he's going to end up going to federal prison. Well, there's going to be a nice bench with Edmund's name right next to Monty's name if he continues down the road that he's going.
Yeah, and the fact that Tarverdian has stated that he doesn't know the last time when he paid income tax, that's not a good admission to make.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine?
I couldn't, actually. I mean, that was shocking. Very rarely in my life am I shocked. I wasn't shocked by the bankruptcy, the Chapter 7, saying zero income. I was surprised. When I saw the admission by Tarverdian, I don't remember the last time when I've paid taxes, I was actually shocked by that.
It's just a statement that I don't care if it's true. You don't say it.
Yeah, and I was shocked that he said it, not that he did or he didn't. I don't care if he did or he didn't. I was shocked that he admitted that publicly.
It's just nuts. It's like ringing a bell. I mean, you look and you go, oh, my God, why don't you just – it's like taking it and having a bunch of wolves around a place, but you're in a safe place, and now I'm going to start throwing hot dogs outside to attract them. My God.
So from Ronda Rousey's perspective, John, worst case scenario, she gets knocked out by Holly Holm. But as we move the timeline forward, I guess worst case scenario is that she loses her head trainer in Edmund Tarverdian, who's also her striking coach, and she loses her home gym, Glendale Fighting Club. That's probably worst case scenario. Again, there are no legal ramifications directly for Ronda Rousey, but it's the little things that sometimes can add up. Like I was talking about earlier with Mike Tyson, when Customato's death sort of knocked down that first domino.
Yeah, but a little bit different situation. When you're looking at Mike Tyson, what happened with Mike Tyson? Exactly like you were saying. Look at Customato was the guy. You know, Mike loved Cus. Cus was his world, and he trusted him. And anything that Cus said, Mike would do. And Cus was in control of Mike's world. And then Cus dies, and Jimmy Jacobs takes that place. And Jimmy Jacobs is a good guy, but Jimmy Jacobs dies shortly thereafter. And Bill Clayton was the attorney who then started to handle Mike's, you know, entire, you know, value and situation. And Mike started having people chomp in his ear. Don King, you know, this guy is a little, you can't trust him. And it was just that pecking of that little hammer hitting that wall. And finally the wall started to crack. And finally, when King was able to peck enough at it, Mike didn't believe that, you know, he could trust anybody. And then he was only trusting, you know, Don King, who obviously was the person that was going to rip him off. And, you know, he only, I think he put, you know, like what, charged him $86,000 for towels or something like that.
There was a story that I think Don King's daughter was the president of the Mike Tyson fan club, getting $100,000 a year, and Tyson had no idea.
Yeah, and Tyson was paying for it.
That's
you know,
right.
And you look and you go, oh, my God. But, you know, everything was set up for Mike, and you're right. You know, you look at the thing that was, you know, it was sad about Mike is the training that changed. You know, what he had when he had Kevin, you know, he was being trained a certain way, and the style that Cuss had, you know, developed through Floyd Patterson, and then, you know, Mike Tyson started using that peekaboo style that he used. Kevin was the guy that he was the right one for it. And then when they got rid of Kevin, you knew, uh-oh, he's in trouble. And he, you know, he at that point, from that point in his career, he never did anything better. He never learned anything more. Everything just started to decay and erode because those skills, they're perishable. This is a perishable skill set. And when you are not working to keep that skill set at that level, it's going to diminish. And that's exactly what happened with Mike Tyson in his career. Those skills diminished. That brought him down to a lower level to where guys were able to beat him because he wasn't that guy back when he ended up having that team that took care of him. Ronda's a different beast, though. She's a little bit different in, you know, just the way she goes about life and her world. She's more in control of it than Mike was. And so I look at Ronda in this. Ronda, you know, this is going to affect her. She, you know, she cares about Edmund. She cares about, you know, the fight club where she works out. But she can go on with anyone. And with her mindset, I don't see it affecting her the way it affected Mike.
John, as a final point on this, I think you have to look at, too, the evolution of MMA journalism. 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, this story doesn't get reported, but MMA journalism has really gone from just fan sites and message boards and some previews and some glowing interviews to real journalism. Some people don't like real journalism. Some people don't like investigative journalism, but it does show that I think MMA, we continue to grow up as a sport. We've had Mark Raimondi on, a buddy of ours, outstanding investigative reporter. This wasn't his story, but we've had him twice on this program. There are a lot of people doing more than just, oh, here's this fighter profile, or here's who I think is going to win. It's real serious journalism. And unfortunately for Edmund Tarverdian, because of that, now we're talking about his case. Now it's out there. It's published. It's on the internet, and it becomes a pretty big story in our sport.
Yeah, you're completely right. There's no doubt. Dana used to talk all the time about the MMA media and said, this is a bunch of goddamn fucking bloggers. And, back then he was right. You know, not all of them, but a lot of them, and a lot of the ones that were, you know, coming up with the stuff. But you look at the people that are out there now and what they're doing. You look at, you know, the Mark Raimondis, the Luke Thomases, the Errol Hawanis. You look at these people. These are righteous journalists. They're righteous media people. John Morgan. These are guys that, you know what, they're not only MMA fans. These are journalists that cover the sport of MMA, and they come up with great stories on fighters' perspectives, you know, backgrounds of fighters, things like that. But they also come up with investigative journalism. You know, Mark Raimondi did the great job of, you know, that whole thing with Explode and looking at that promotion. That's what investigative journalism is supposed to do. And these guys are out there now, and there's, you know, high quality people, and you're not going to hide stuff forever. And then if you do something that you look and you go, not only am I doing something here that I know is wrong, but you are a public figure like Edmund is, man, you know what? Someone gets word that, hey, Edmund filed, you know, for bankruptcy. They're going to, if they're that investigative journalist, they're going to start looking into it. They're going to start digging. And trust me, once they start digging, they're going to find it. And if it's there, they're going to find it, and then they're going to bring it out, and then you're in this position that you're in.
Well, MMA investigative journalists will probably be all over this story if it unfolds, but it was actually KLAS Television in Las Vegas, the CBS affiliate, who first reported that the UFC is considering purchasing naming rights for the new $375 million, 20,000-seat privately funded arena set to open on the Las Vegas Strip in April. The UFC has already announced that this venue will host UFC 200, scheduled for July 9th, 2016. John, I really find this amazing. So we're closing in on November 12th, which is the 22nd anniversary of the very first Ultimate Fighting Championship. You, of course, were there. This story about naming rights really illustrates to me just how far the UFC has come in a relatively short period of time. Could you have imagined when you were sitting at McNichols Arena the day before November 11th? In 22 years, there's going to be this billion-dollar thing called the UFC, and they're going to be spending millions of dollars on naming rights so they can essentially have a home arena. It's unthinkable.
It's awesome.
It is awesome. It's really cool. It's cool. It's cool for the UFC, and it's even cooler for MMA.
You know what? I think overall, you know, people can sit there and say, why would they want to do that? It's marketing genius. You know, if you name that new arena after your company, you know, the UFC arena, whatever they're going to call it, UFC Center, you know, that's the same as, you know, look at Texas Stadium, the AT&T, you know, they're the sponsor of that. AT&T gets huge benefits off of being the sponsor of that Texas Stadium, because what are they, you know, when they, we're at AT&T Stadium, you know, that name goes out, and that is just part of marketing, and that is an important element of any business, and especially when that business is a fighting business that uses that arena and you're fighting in your arena, you know, come on, it all works out. And although it's going to cost them money, absolutely, you know, everything is about understanding what is that money going to buy me. And the UFC is smart enough to understand that that money spent is really intelligently spent money as far as marketing for what they're doing and their product.
So it looks like this will be sort of the de facto home stadium, which I guess MGM Grand Garden has been, but this will be the de facto home stadium for the UFC because they are based in Las Vegas. That's their headquarters. That's really their epicenter. I think realistically it is. And also I think from a mindset, they see themselves based in Las Vegas. But with naming rights, so this is a joint partnership. It's all private money. Anschutz Entertainment Group and MGM. There's going to be a lot of major boxings in this building. It's also being built partly to get an NHL expansion club. So let's say that there is NHL in Las Vegas at this arena. So the UFC is mentioned how many times on every NHL broadcast? And that's not just the U.S. and Canada. There's global television with the National Hockey League. It's amazing. It's the outreach.
Absolutely.
And I like the fact, too, that you could have world championship boxing, a world heavyweight title fight or a welterweight title fight, middleweight.
A world heavyweight boxing fight from the UFC Center. Oh, that's awesome.
Now, could you have imagined that November 12th, 1993 in Denver?
Floyd Mayweather Jr.'s comeback fight and his welterweight title fight at the UFC Center. That's great.
It is great. And whatever the UFC pays, no figures have been discussed, but I was looking online for some relatively comparable figures. So 49ers, of course, in the NFL have a new stadium.
Levi's stadium
is spending $11 million per year.
Okay.
American Airlines, which is an older arena, it's in Dallas. It's the home of the NHL Dallas Stars, NBA's Dallas Mavericks. American Airlines pays $6.5 million a year. So I'm guessing it's going to be somewhere between those two figures. And I think it's going to be money well spent by the UFC.
I don't know. I think it'll be less right now, honestly.
Do you really?
Yeah, I do. And the reason why I do is because there is no professional team playing out of that arena. They're trying to get something there, but until it does, I think it's going to be actually be lower than the American Airlines arena or something like that. I look at it and, you know, what people need to understand is this new arena, it's owned by the entire company that, you know, Sean brought up, but the MGM. The MGM ended up being pretty much the home de facto. It used to be the Mandalay Bay was one of the arenas that was used, but all those Mandalay Bay, MGM, they're all owned by the same company. So it really didn't matter. The reason they kept going back to the MGM Grand Garden is there's more seats. It's a bigger arena. Well, now what they're going to do, they're going to end up having the MGM Grand Garden is going to be there for concerts. They're going to set it up more for concerts, you know, comedy things, entertainment in the fashion of, you know, those types of things. But all the fighting elements that used to be at the Grand Garden, all those are going over to the new arena. So the UFC is going to end up being in that new arena all the time. You know, the big, you know, championship boxing matches are going to end up being in that arena. So if they can get an NHL team in there, it's huge. And I think the price would end up going up a little bit, you know, that next year. But with what they're doing, the marketing for them, you know, that marketing is a key aspect of getting people to look at your company. Look at your logo. Look at, and see what your product is. And this is a way that they can be out there in a fashion that no other fighting group. There is no WWE, you know, stadium. There is no Top Rank stadium. There is no Golden Boy stadium. There is no, you know, Premier Boxing Champion stadium. It would be the first fighting organization that actually had a stadium that they were sponsoring that they had their name on.
And it further pushes the UFC into the mainstream, further pushes our sport of MMA into the mainstream, which are both great things. You know, there's the acceptability factor. It really wasn't all that long ago, was it, John, that you were going around on television saying this isn't human cockfighting, this isn't barbaric, this isn't something from the Middle Ages, because you were in that position, I guess, as recently as the early part of last decade.
Christ, what are you talking about? We couldn't even get in an arena. We were in tents, okay? We were in pub, in those,
it really is
the
amazing
marshmallow
though,
tents.
I've commentated a few fights in the marshmallow tents, but
there you go, man.
It, you know, before UFC 1, there was Vale Tudo, there was Catch as Catch Can. There's been a long history of mixed match fighting, strong style works in Japan. Even Pancrase started before the UFC, although to me that wasn't mixed martial arts because of the restrictive rules. But you have to really think, this is such a young sport. It's not just a young sport chronologically. It has a young attitude. It attracts young fans. Not that it doesn't attract plenty of older fans. It does. But just in spirit, it's a very young sport, as well as about to turn 22. And it's moved so rapidly. The NFL has gotten bigger in the last 22 years. Baseball has gotten smaller in the last 22 years. But there aren't those seismic shifts like we're seeing in MMA.
Yeah, it's you know, as fast as this sport has grown, and you know, you look at it, and it, you know, I'm going to say it's the last 10 years. You know, it's been around 22 years, we'll say, but you know, Zuffa has owned it from, you know, 2000. The end of 2000 is when they bought it, so we'll say 2001, and so 15 years. You know, they spent 5 years of getting their butts kicked. Let's just be honest about it. You know, they lost a lot of money, but they stuck with it, and they ended up, you know, doing the Ultimate Fighter. And from that Ultimate Fighter, that's when that real change came. And that's when this thing started, you know, the wheel started turning in the right direction, and it started running down the road in a way that, you know what, they were able to do things. But in the last 10 years, people have no idea. You know, if you're a part of it when I was in the beginning, and you get to see this entire, you know, progress of what's occurred. The last 10 years they've exploded with this sport, exploded worldwide, exploded in the, you know, the conscious of modern day people that you didn't know anything about fighting. Now exploding with someone like Ronda Rousey bringing in housewives and little girls. She got little girls dressing up in Halloween as her.
Crazy.
You know, come on. You know, it's just crazy. You know, I can remember, you know, back when my son was small, I made him a Hulk Hogan Halloween outfit, because that's how big the WWE was. They were huge, you know, and so Hulk Hogan was a costume, you know, and it wasn't a costume you could buy. I had to make it. But I remember my son was so proud of walking around as Hulk Hogan, and he looked awesome. I got him a giant muscle shirt thing. It was, I filled it with padding. He looked free. He had the championship belt. He looked so cool. But now girls are doing it with Ronda Rousey, and you look and you go, that just shows you how big the sport is getting. When you got kids dressing up as your champions, it's saying you've done something right. The sport's a little bit bigger than it was when I was part of it, you know, in the beginning.
I think always, and I mean always, there are going to be people who are against mixed martial arts. I think there are people who are always going to be against combat sports. I mean, the NFL takes a lot of heat for concussion. So you're not going to win over everybody.
But I don't like figure skating. Exactly. I look at men's figure skating and I go, why? Why do you want to move like that? Okay. You know, it's like, you know, I look at it and go, dude, that's just not who I am. I can't watch that. I can't do it. I obviously can't do it. But I can't watch it. For me, ice is for a couple of things, okay? It's for drinks, all right? That's a good thing, and it's for hockey. If you're going to skate on ice, hockey is the thing. Okay, you want to do speed skating? We'll do speed skating. That's going fast too. But when it comes to, you know, certain things, it's like, you know, flipping up and around and doing these little, you know, ballerina movements, I think is ridiculous. But it doesn't matter what I think, because there is a huge section of the population that loves it. And as long as they love it and they want to watch it, they should be able to. The same as if someone wants to watch fighting, they should be able to.
And John, taking your men's figure skating analogy, I think as we go forward, the people who say, I don't like MMA, are just going to say, I choose not to watch it, like you choose and I choose not to watch men's figure skating. They're not going to be the people who in the 90s and early 2000s were leading literally a crusade saying, this must be banned. This is the ruinization of our democracy.
Come on, Sean. Let's be honest. You watch men's figure skating.
If I can digress, if I can digress for a moment. Why do people care about figure skating for 1 week every 4 years during the Olympics and then they stop caring about it? Yeah. I find it unwatchable. In the Olympics, I like to watch the men's hockey and that's it. And I'm sorry if that offends anybody.
When it comes on ice, I'll watch the speed skating and I'll watch the hockey. When it comes to anything else, the boob tube goes off. You know? And then, again, that's just who I am and that's my opinion on it. Should not matter to anyone but me. But same as when people sit there and say, oh, fighting is bad, that opinion should not matter to anybody but you because that's your opinion. You don't understand it. It's not part of who you are. Your concept of fighting is completely different than what is reality. But, that's just the way people are always going to try to say, oh, you shouldn't do that. Everyone should be allowed to do what they're doing as long as what they're doing is not bringing harm to other people not involved in that situation.
John, as a final point on this, I think for a lot of people, assuming the UFC does purchase the naming rights, and the indications are in the report from KLAS Television in Las Vegas that they're considering it. But if they do, a lot of people will say, this is the final step. MMA, the UFC, finally legitimized in terms of the sports scene. Now, for you and me, it's always been legitimized. But when did you have that moment that you thought, you know what, this just isn't kind of this rogue outlaw sport that Art Navy put together, that this sport actually is now kind of being accepted by traditional sports fans? When did that moment occur for you?
Easy. UFC 40.
Interesting.
That was it. There was no doubt. That was the time that, all the things that had occurred. And, and we've been in big, arenas and things like that with a lot of people. But it was UFC 40 and the way that it was bringing in more fans. It was, Ken Shamrock, was coming back and he's going to fight Tito Ortiz. And that to me was, truthfully at the time, I thought Tito's going to run through him. And, that was no disrespect for Ken. It was just a matter of, stronger athlete, faster athlete. At this time, things had changed and I just saw Tito being able to beat Ken. But it was the perception of people and what the way they were looking at the sport. And all of a sudden, the news media that was coming in and then the arena was so electric over it. And they were talking about it before and they were talking about it after. And that was the show that I looked at. And that's when the UFC was in trouble. They were in trouble. And there was a lot of bad things happening. But it was that show that I said, it's going to make it. Yeah, they're in trouble, but it's going to make it based upon this. This is different. People are starting to look at it in a different way. That was the show that I personally said, it's going to be here. Because I was always concerned that it was, someday going to go away. It was just, too much money, too much cost, too many people against it. I always had that concern, but that was the one that in my mind to this day, it was UFC 40 that I knew the sport was going to make it.
Big John and I are back with you next week for an all-new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, @podcastMMA for this show and for us personally, @JohnMcCarthyMMA and @SeanWheelock. To ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On, email us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Again, that's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. For John McCarthy, producer Chris Lakin, and our entire crew, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been a presentation of Lineup Media Group, online at lineupmediagroup.com.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in the comments section of the iTunes podcast store. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring the show, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com or check out our additional lineup of podcasts, including Ocho Man, Behind the 8 Ball, the Whiskey Philosopher, and Youth Baseball Talk.